Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, pledging to help end child hunger in the Carolinas through ongoing support of Second Harvest Food Bank of Metrolina. Details about this initiative at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, COVID numbers continue their troubling climb. We're hitting marks not seen since earlier this year, with infections affecting a younger population. Mecklenburg County recommends we all wear masks in public, vaccinated or not, but area school systems decide to make masks optional. CMS announces their decision later today. Charlotte Center City Partners issues their own 2040 vision plan. A settlement is reached with CMPD over the tear gas ambush during the George Floyd protest. And the streetcar's arrival is imminent, we think. Here to bring us up to date on those stories and more is WFAE's healthcare reporter, Claire Donnelly. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Hunter Sines has broken away from watching the Olympics. He's a reporter for WCNC-TV. He joins us this morning. Good morning.
Good morning, Mike.
Soccer is on, huh? Mary C. Curtis is Mary C. Curtis is a columnist for Roll Call and host of their Equal Time podcast. Good morning.
Good morning, and I'm so glad Claire is here.
Yeah. And Eric Spanberg is with us. I'm so glad he's here, too. He's the managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. Good morning, Eric.
Good to be with you, Mike.
Unfortunately, COVID-19 is the gift that keeps on giving. Our numbers are on the rise again nationwide and here in Mecklenburg County. And the county's health director, Gibby Harris, joined us for the hour yesterday and told us that it wasn't that long ago, the end of June, that the county was averaging about 40 new cases a day. But now it's several hundred cases a day, including almost 400 new cases just on Wednesday.
We're still nowhere near where we were in January. But it's the exponential growth we're seeing that's a major concern for us.
On Tuesday, the state reported 2,600 new cases, 1,000 more than it reported on Monday. Yesterday, new cases topped 3,000. Given vaccination hesitancy and a certain amount of militancy surrounding wearing masks, do health officials, Claire, believe that this virus is gaining the upper hand?
I mean, that would be hard to say, but I think yes. I mean, we're hanging out still at around half in Mecklenburg County. And we know that that the Delta variant is much more contagious. So Mandy Cohen said yesterday during her press conference that the original strain of the coronavirus would, if you had it, you would infect between 2 to 3 other people. Now you can infect up to 6 other people. And it's you have much more virus in your nose and throat, which is what makes it so much more contagious.
And I read this morning that it's as contagious as or more contagious than chickenpox. How contagious is chickenpox? It's been a long time since I've had chickenpox.
I've never had chickenpox, but very contagious. Yeah, okay. Very contagious. And that's why, because there's so much more virus circulating. And also, I think you're talking about that New York Times stories, which also found that possibly vaccinated people are spreading it as well. So we can carry it, even though we may not necessarily be symptomatic.
Right. So. The average new daily cases have gone up, as you said, I think, sixfold in the past month, mostly due to that Delta variant, which is more contagious than the previous iterations of this virus. And when you get it, it can really do much more damage much more quickly than the original version. One healthcare official has said that the Delta variant is the most contagious respiratory virus they had ever seen. And the increase in infections is happening all over the country. Is this primarily because there are people out there who are just refusing to get vaccinated?
Yes and no. I think there's also the issue of it being a brand new virus, right? So we didn't have kind of the system in place to deal with this. We're sort of constantly learning about it. But I also think that the lagging vaccination rate is definitely playing a role.
North Carolina and other states have implemented various incentive programs. I think we have 4 iterations of $1 million lottery and some chance to win a college education if you'll get the vaccine. Yesterday, the president announced a $100 incentive for people to go and get the shot. Should there be a carrot or a stick here?
Oh, man. So I will say we have seen in the past couple of days vaccination rates ticking up in North Carolina.
Is that because of the incentives or because of the rising infection rate? I think it's scaring people.
I think it's because people are afraid of Delta. We know that with the $1 million lottery, you know, Governor Cooper even said that we didn't really see an uptick when he announced that he was going to start this $1 million lottery program. I think it's the concern over how contagious the Delta variant is, and the fact that it, because so many older people have been vaccinated, more and more young people are going to the hospital yeah. with this virus because they are the unprotected at this point.
Hunter, did you want to chime in on this?
Yeah, I was just going to add, a couple of my colleagues had went out to vaccination spots over the past couple of days, and a lot of people are telling them they see case numbers going up and they just don't want more restrictions. And another thing is they have to do it now because some of their jobs are mandating it. So those are some of the bigger reasons why people are getting the vaccines.
It is younger people who are contracting this around the country more frequently than older people. Part of the reason for that is that older people have already become vaccinated and younger people either couldn't or didn't. We have two relatively young people on this panel, Claire and Hunter. I'm curious what your peers, your friends, this is all anecdotal, but I'm curious as to whether they are vaccinated or getting
Thanks
vaccinated.
Thanks a lot, Mike.
Or what? Well, I'm just being a realist, Mary. We've been around a long time.
So, yes, maybe I'm a unique population because I am the health reporter. But I think part of it is that, so Hunter mentioned the case numbers are ticking back up. If you were someone who was hesitant initially to get the vaccine and you saw more and more of your friends getting the vaccine and the numbers started to go down, maybe you just felt kind of a lack of urgency, right? And Gibby Harris said as much, that there wasn't so much that people were scared to get the vaccine, but it was just sort of like, well, now they're everywhere. I don't need to rush. Our numbers are okay. Now we're sort of back in this, as you said, stick situation where the Delta variant is more contagious. Yeah. People are going to the hospital with it. The only thing we know right now for sure is that it is more contagious. There's still sort of some talk on whether it actually makes you sicker, but I do think that that fear is there.
You have artfully avoided my question. Hunter, what about you? I mean, people in your peer group.
People who are around my age who I hang out with here, a majority of them, if not all of them, are vaccinated and are clearly doing the right thing. But I do agree that there is a part of the population with younger people who definitely have this sense that, well, you know, at the beginning of this, it wasn't really killing people my age. It wasn't getting people my age that sick. And I think that's starting to change. I mean, the warnings are out there that more people my age are being hospitalized with this, that it is getting more serious for this age group. So I think we're all hopeful that we start taking it more seriously. But I do think there is an invincibility factor when it comes to younger people, sadly.
The positivity rate of this virus had fallen to under 2% in this area in June, but by mid-July it had risen to 5%, and on Monday we were at 10.6%. What was the figure that we were shooting for, Claire, when we were deciding whether or not it was wise to reopen the economy?
5%. Wow. So we are double that now.
There's also this matter of so-called breakthrough cases of the virus infecting fully vaccinated people. That does not mean, as some say, that the vaccine doesn't work. The vaccines are known to be somewhere around 95% effective. That means 5% of those folks may come down with some form of COVID. It's usually not as bad as it would be had you not been vaccinated. Sometimes it can be. But how many breakthrough cases have there been in this area? Do you know, Claire?
We don't know for Mecklenburg County. We're supposed to get some information on that today. So we know at the state level, as of July 11th, preliminary numbers, we have 4,660 breakthrough cases. And of that, 321 people were hospitalized and 61 people died. But as you said, Mike, vaccines aren't 100% effective. They're never 100% effective. And that is also, we should note, at least that 46-60 number, a very, very like minuscule amount of the total number of people who have been vaccinated, which is some 4.9 million in North Carolina now. So,
and it would seem to me that 95% protection is better than zero.
And
I'm not a genius at math.
And what public health officials have been saying is a breakthrough case doesn't necessarily mean you are hospitalized or will die from the virus. Right. And that is what they're trying to hammer home is at this point, we need to accept COVID is going to be here for a while. We're going to try our best to keep people out of the hospital and from dying from this virus. And the best way to do that is vaccines.
Mary.
Yeah. You see, when you have these breakthrough cases that people are saying, so tell me, doctors and scientists, does the vaccine work or doesn't it work? Or should we wear masks or shouldn't we wear masks? Why do you keep changing your stories? And I heard the Surgeon General, Dr. Vivek Murthy, say, actually, it's a good sign because it shows that science, we're always learning more about this virus, which is very tricky and very effective. And we're learning more about vaccines and masking. But, you know, human nature is to say, tell me what I need to do. But science actually works against that because you are constantly learning new things.
It is. And we've talked about this on this program and others in the past. It has been very confusing. And there have been lots of different messages and changes of direction on how we should act and what we should do and whether we should wear masks or not wear. It's all been very confusing for a lot of people. But I heard a great analogy the other day from a medical professional saying that this is a battle. This is a war. And if you're in a real war on a battlefield, you go in with a plan. But if the other guy, the enemy, does something that's not part of your plan, you change your plan on the fly or you're going to lose the battle. And that's what's happening here. Gibby Harris held a press conference on Wednesday, our health director in Mecklenburg County, at which she recommended that we all return to wearing masks indoors, even if you are vaccinated. But yesterday on this program, she said she wouldn't go so far as a community-wide mask mandate.
I'm not sure that a mandate is really going to be the solution.
Why not?
So I don't think that either Governor Cooper or Gibby Harris can really do a mandate at this point. I mean, Cooper is a Democratic governor with a red legislature, a purple state. Gibby has to get the approval of the six towns. That's had limited success in the past. Historically, you know, it hasn't been easy to get that consensus. So that, yeah. And then we've already seen Republicans like Senate Leader Phil Berger in North Carolina accusing the CDC of flip-flopping and saying, you know, ignore the latest CDC guidance. So I think that, as you said, Mary and Mike, the problem is that when you change the guidance on people, you run the risk of undermining public trust. You run the risk of people saying, if you said we could get vaccinated and not wear a mask, and now you're saying we need to wear a mask again, then why should I trust what you say on vaccines? And I think that that's the really tough line that public health officials are walking right now with the messaging.
Because
and it's become so political.
You know,
we've seen Berger call it left-wing bureaucracy. Everything has become political at this point, even health and science. So you are fighting against that. And some of these states, you know, are throwing away vaccines because people just won't get them.
There were two press conferences yesterday at high levels. The governor of North Carolina held one about this, and so did the president of the United States. We'll come back and talk about the Governor Cooper conference in just a couple of seconds. It's Charlotte Talks and the Local News Roundup on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks and the Local News Roundup on 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Claire Donnelly has been dominating the conversation. She's our healthcare reporter for WFAE News, and there's a reason for that. We're talking about COVID. That's why you're here. Hunter Sines is also with us from WCNC-TV, Mary C. Curtis from Roll Call, and host of their Equal Time podcast, and Eric Spanberg is the managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. Yesterday afternoon, Governor Cooper held a press conference and once again urged all North Carolinians to wear masks indoors in public places. But he came no closer, as we just said, to issuing any kind of a mask-wearing mandate. He also made a plea for people to get vaccinated. He referenced our rising numbers of infections and said, I want to be clear about why. Unvaccinated people, he said, are driving this resurgence and getting themselves and other people sick.
Get a vaccine today. Don't wait until you or a family member is sick and going on a ventilator. Don't wait until we run out of hospital beds. Don't wait until skyrocketing numbers threaten to shut businesses or cancel sports. Don't wait until you infect somebody you love. Get a vaccine today.
Would it be fair to say that that's the most adamant the governor has been about anything involving this pandemic since the very beginning?
You do sense like, you know, it's like, what's left to do at this point? You know, you've tried the mandate, you've tried giving away money, you've tried every incentive. Now we're trying some of the sticks, as you referred to it, Mike, you know, with he made that decision on the cabinet level agencies and having to have proof of vaccination. I mean, to Claire's point, I think it's just, he knows that a mask mandate isn't going to work. And so the vaccine is really the only option to stamp this thing out. And he's just begging people to do it.
I don't know why it wouldn't work, but because of that, he did yesterday allow the mask mandate to lapse.
Businesses know what to do. People know what to do. Schools know what to do when it comes to masks. Where we are going to focus is getting more people vaccinated.
Did he offer any idea, Claire, on how he might achieve that?
Well, as Eric just said, they're going to mandate that cabinet level agencies, so that affects about 55,000 state employees, show proof of vaccination. And if not, they're going to have to wear a mask and be tested at least once a week. And we've seen similar things with the hospital systems in North Carolina. I think that that's sort of what's left. To Eric's point, I mean, I think what's left is mandating vaccines because masks.
And also, Claire, I'm sure everyone who listened to that call, one of the things that was really interesting that he said was he kept going back to what Claire just mentioned about the hospital systems and others who have mandated. And he said explicitly several times, I know private sector companies have gone farther than public sector, and I hope they'll keep doing it. In other words, it's really becoming all about the stick more than the carrot, and the private sector can really start to drive this. That's what he wants to see happen.
Sort of saying your move, private sector, yeah.
So Mecklenburg County's Health Director Gibby Harris on this program yesterday, it told us that she recommended to CMS Superintendent Ernest Winston that masks be worn in schools by teachers and students and staff. They will make they're in discussions even as we speak at CMS. Well, I'll update you on that in a second because we've heard from Andos Helms, our education reporter, about what's going on in that meeting. But CMS will make that decision today. Other school systems have already decided, many of them, that mask wearing will be optional. And a lot of that has to do with a political point of view, obviously, which is also ties into another pressure being felt by school board and administrators, and that is parents. At a Gaston County School Board meeting this week, parents, some with signs that read, no mask, vaccine kills, parent choice, lobbied the board not to require masking.
You know what? I didn't vote for the CDC.
It should be the choice of the parents whether their own child wears a mask.
What is your legacy going to be? Government intrusion?
We all know that children are not affected by this virus, and the scientific data supports this.
Let me quickly point out that that is not true. The scientific evidence shows that children are susceptible. They are dying today, this morning, as this program airs, of the Delta variant. Some have been hospitalized as well. Do parents not know this? Is this word not getting out? Seriously.
Mike, I think that, I mean, it's been talked about so much, but it's the misinformation and disinformation. People live in bubbles. And in other cases, they just simply refuse to believe what is proven scientific evidence.
Mary?
Also, it's really, it is political, and it's being put as a matter of personal choice and personal freedom, as opposed to this is a matter of community. And the fact that, you know, there are some children who can't get vaccinated. There are people who are immunocompromised and some who can't, for medical reasons, get the vaccine. So many people are in danger. Also, in the schools, you're dealing with teachers, staff, and other folks. And we're really not considering, in some senses, that they might not want to be in this atmosphere where a lot of people are going unmasked. So as long as it's couched in a political way, it's going to be really hard to get past it. National polls are showing there's a certain amount of people who haven't gotten it who say they will not get it.
At that Gaston County School Board meeting, only two parents, one of them being Sierra Hall, spoke in favor of masking. She said that ignoring the Delta variant won't make it go away.
We are all tired of COVID. I'm tired of it too. My daughter is suffering from, you know, being home virtual all last year. Even with that being said, we still cannot drop the ball on this.
So, go ahead, Eric. Go ahead. Sorry.
Well, I just want to mention one thing, Mike, that ties into this, which is Dr. Mandy Cohen yesterday mentioned a couple of trouble spots in the state in terms of just overall spread of the Delta variant and COVID. She mentioned the Sandhills and she mentioned Charlotte-Mecklenburg, or she mentioned Charlotte, but she mentioned specifically the Ring counties, which we've talked about this before. So you just played a cut from Gaston County. While it's 52% vaccination rate in Mecklenburg County, you know what it is in Gaston County? It's 34%. And when you go around those Ring counties, it's 30 to 40% in all those counties, meaning, of course, that it's even a higher risk there. So I think that has to be noted, too, as you hear parents saying they don't want their children wearing masks at school.
So earlier, after Gibby Harris recommended to CMS school superintendent Ernest Winston that everybody be masked in schools, Ernest Winston sent out a memo to the school board, and a copy of that memo was sent from a school board member to a parent. So now it's out there, and the school system has confirmed the memo. Right now, they are meeting, and Ann Doss Helms, WFAE's education reporter, is in that meeting, and she has tweeted out there is no decision from the board yet on whether or not there will be a mask mandate. Ernest Winston obviously is recommending one. Winston says CMS is not in a position to require employees to be vaccinated. Why not? Anybody know the answer to that? Is he prohibited from controlling his own employees? All right, CMS's Human Resources Director says unmasked students who are exposed to COVID will have to quarantine and will not have access to remote learning. People in the audience at this meeting right now are shouting over the Human Resources Director as she makes the case for a mask mandate. So we have parents very much opposed to this in that meeting. If COVID cases continue to rise, and young people and faculty and staff start to get sick from this virus, are we going to see a return to online learning?
Wow, that's quite a loaded question, Mike. I mean, I think, you know, for a lot of the people who are vehemently opposed to wearing masks, they're just as vehemently opposed to online school. So you do wonder, it just does not seem logical, you know, where we're going here. Go ahead, Claire.
I just wanted to say the argument that we've heard from public health officials like Gibby Harris and from Mandy Cohen about why masks in schools are important is that seat time is important. So students will, as you said, have to quarantine for 10 days if they're not wearing masks. But if both students are wearing masks and one of those students tests positive for COVID, the other masked student does not have to quarantine. So school continues as normal.
Hunter.
Blair hit the nail on the head.
Okay. She stole your thunder there. Okay.
Hunter.
Your help. You go for it.
She knows her stuff.
in the memo that Ernest Winston sent to the school board, and which they're discussing even as we speak, he cites the rise in Delta variant cases and the inability to vaccinate children under 12 because the vaccines have not been approved for them. So they're completely defenseless. Their only defense is social distancing and mask wearing. That fact that children under 12 who can both catch and carry the virus and are not yet eligible for vaccines came out yesterday in our conversation with Gibby Harris, and CBS News reports that school-aged children in Louisiana now make up the third largest number of new COVID infections in that state. Children there are more ill, they require higher levels of care, and health officials believe that they will see increasing deaths of school-aged children in the coming weeks in Louisiana. This seems like a no-brainer to me, that parents would be on board with this, that school systems would be on board with this. But that's not the case.
And
can
sadly,
anybody explain this to me, please?
You are going to see these numbers worse in states like some of the states that have not expanded Medicaid. So if kids get sick, then they also probably won't have as much access to health care. And so you will see, I think, it disproportionately affecting poor folks, people that don't have as many resources to health care. And this could be really quite a tragedy.
It's political, as everybody said, it's political. And and it's also about individual choice and feeling like, you know, it should be your choice whether you want your child to wear a mask or not. And
Mike, I don't have an answer. Obviously, none of us did, but I am curious about the question you posed about CMS employees, because everything I've seen and read lately has been that you can, as an employer, require vaccines. So I'm not arguing necessarily with the school system, but I would like to hear the answer maybe next time Andos Helms is on. You know, we can delve into that.
It just puzzles me that these political leaders who make laws and rules and regulations on countless things that many people disagree with seem to be incapable of coming up with a solution or mandate, or you, if you don't get vaccinated, you can't come, you can't leave your house. I mean, just silly things like that. Why can't they do these things? Parents, for instance, take their kids to the pediatrician all the time and take their advice on all kinds of things. But the American Association...
Including immunizations, Mike, including immunizations.
Yes, and the American Association of Pediatrics has said masks in schools they should be necessary. And yet parents don't want to follow those pediatricians' suggestions. Makes no sense to me. Charlotte businesses are said to be having mixed reactions to the possibility of having to require or even ask customers to wear masks. Others have already instituted that policy. Except for places like bars and restaurants, why do those reluctant businesses believe this is a problem or even an inconvenience? It's a mask.
Well, but I mean, you know, we've gone through this. How many dollars in the jar would we have to insert to go through all the fights and all the sort of rebellion of people who just refuse or don't want to wear masks? And if you're running a business, that is a very difficult thing to do. You don't want to antagonize your customers. And obviously right now, when for many businesses, there's not as much, although it's recovered, you know, of late, they've been through a year and a half of diminished revenue. It is a tricky thing. And, you know, some business owners are not thrilled that the governor has said, you know, the businesses know best, because then it's on the businesses to sort of enforce and be the heavy, if you will. It would be much easier from a business owner's perspective if they could just say, hey, look, the governor's order says this, and this is what I have to do.
Everybody's passing the ball to the next person, and nobody wants to hold on to it.
This, too, will be geographic. I mean, because you'll see a lot of red states, I'm sure, the businesses want to open up. I heard a New York restaurateur basically say, I'm going to require not only our employees, but our customers to have vaccines and show proof. And someone asked, well, how will you enforce it? And he said, well, the same way as we card people to serve them liquor. Okay. So, you know, this really is going to be, you're going to see these geographic differences for businesses, for who has vaccines and not. But the thing is, we're all one country. So people are going to go from one place to another. We'll all be affected by it.
And there was a story yesterday about a restaurateur, a bar owner, who said, I'm going to make sure that my customers are not vaccinated or they're not getting in. So you got both sides of the same coin. 5 years after HB2 was passed by the legislature in response to a non-discrimination ordinance passed by Charlotte City Council, a chastened state has backed off Other municipalities have instituted their own non-discrimination ordinances, and this week Charlotte City Council got a look at a newly proposed ordinance. Councilman Larkin Eggleston was quick to tell WSOC-TV, however, that they are making sure all of their ducks are in a row before proceeding.
The elevator pitch on this ordinance is it expands the people who are protected by our non-discrimination ordinance, our non-discrimination rules. It says that people cannot be discriminated against for all the reasons that they've not been able to be in the past.
So what does this ordinance, which is yet to be voted on, yet to be discussed really by council, and they'll do that Monday, what does it say? What does it do? What does it propose?
So this would protect, it now includes race, including natural hairstyle, sex, including pregnancy, sexual orientation, gender identity, religion, national origin, family status. There are a number of things that it's now protecting against. I think the most controversial thing that Patrick Baker, the city attorney, pointed out was the employment here of employers who employ 15 people or less. There's no real case law on that. So that would be the most controversial part of what council wants to do, in which they will be talking about it on Monday and voting on it probably August 9th. So I still think there is a bit of discussion. To Eric's point before we went on here, it is going to be interesting to see how council goes for this. This ordinance draft is very close to council members Tarek Bakari's proposal for this. There's a couple of like little language changes, I think, when you compare the two, but it's pretty much his proposal going forward here.
So Tarek is one of two Republicans on a fundamentally Democratic city council. And we have to remind folks that it was a Republican-controlled legislature that instituted HB2 in response to a democratically controlled city council in Charlotte's original ordinance. So what is different about this ordinance than the original ordinance? What's the difference?
One big thing is nobody's going to call it, the bathroom ordinance or the bathroom bill, because that is prohibited from being covered in local ordinances. And in essence, it's just a gray area in terms of which restroom people are using in government publicly owned buildings. So that's a big difference. And Hunter just went through what I think is the other most significant difference, which is this idea of the private employers, 15 employees or less. And city attorney Patrick Baker said something to the effect of, it's your appetite for risk in terms of whether council will want to go with that.
And he's worried about another part of this proposal as well, at least he says he is, and we'll talk about that when we come back, and about a CMPD settlement over the kettling during the George Floyd protests. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Hunter Steins is here with us from WCNC, Mary C. Curtis from Roll Call, Eric Spanberg from the Charlotte Business Journal, and Claire Donnelly from WFAE News. The non-discrimination ordinance that the City Council will take up on Monday is where we left off. This is a new ordinance, not the one that triggered HB2, but it's different in that it doesn't deal with bathrooms. But City Attorney Patrick Baker says that the part that deals on protection for workers based on their race, sex, national origin, and other characteristics may be controversial. Why? Is it just because this is likely to impact employers with 15 or fewer employees? Or just the fact that that stuff is in there?
I was letting Hunter had answered the question earlier, so yeah. I was good. Go ahead, Hunter.
No, so pretty much there is a risk of lawsuit here or legal challenge because there is no previous laws or cases that have been brought up in regards to this. So in some respect, the city of Charlotte, along with some of the other cities who have already put these in place, are sort of going out on a limb in regards to employment of 15 or less.
And that includes protections for natural hair. That specifically refers mostly to African Americans, but there are other ethnic groups, I suppose, that would be impacted by that. But the fact that there is no...
Yeah, it follows like the Crown Acts in other places where particularly African American women have been told in coded and sometimes not so coded language that to look professional You need to not wear your hair as it comes out of your head, but straighten it. So it'll be interesting to see this.
The lack of the bathroom provisions, which of course is what triggered HB2 years ago, leaves transgender people, it seems to me, in a gray area in terms of how they use public facilities. Are there other laws on the books that help them out in that area, or are they on their own here essentially?
I think they're on their own essentially because there's really nothing sort of prohibiting or allowing. So it's just, I don't know. Is it the old don't ask, don't tell that was going on in the 90s sort of? It's just really not defined.
Well, when this law came up before, I would tell people you have probably been in the bathroom with a transgender person and didn't really know. So maybe they'll just keep on doing what they've been doing and people will mind their own business.
The ordinance has not been finalized yet, but a draft leaked and the Charlotte Ledger printed it. And they also spoke to some attorneys that deal with plaintiffs in employment disputes. And those attorneys have called it everything from a momentous ordinance for workers to not as forceful as we may see in other areas of the country. So which is it? And was it designed specifically to be very careful that we don't step on Raleigh's toes?
I think certainly the answer to your second question is yes. I mean, they're trying to avoid the knockdown drag out that went on for a year or more last time around. And the first question, I think it's just as you saw with those attorneys, it's in the eye of the beholder in terms of the effectiveness or not.
Our producer, Chris Miller, says there was a court settlement in 2019 allowing transgender people in North Carolina to use bathrooms confirming to their gender identity in state-run public buildings. So they do have some protections there. Switching gears here, CMPD has reached a settlement in a lawsuit over the police tear gas ambush of protesters last year during the George Floyd protests. Remind us what happened that night on 4th Street.
Yeah, so basically protesters were walking, doing their thing, and they were what's called kettled, where they were funneled into this area of the street, blocked off, surrounded by CMPD officers who have been on body camera saying what the plan was to surround them and then basically use tear gas with no way out.
So this lawsuit was filed 2 weeks after that incident by a group of Charlotte and out-of-state attorneys. It's taken 13 months to reach a settlement. What settlement did they reach?
Yeah, the settlement, you know, both sides are saying this is a step in the right direction, but some of these changes for CMPD, the policy changes, were already in place in September of 2020. So like they can't use the tear gas anymore during protests. They have to warn with dispersal orders in English and Spanish. They can't fire pepper bullets to people's necks or heads. So there have been policy changes, and that's what really this settlement is basically saying, CMPD, you can no longer do XYZ.
And police have to provide protesters two exit points. If they tell them to disperse, they have to provide two ways out so that they can, in fact, disperse. And as you said, some of these things were already in place because CMPD Chief Johnny Jennings said that furor over police tactics in the immediate aftermath led the police to do some soul searching and changing. This settlement is in place for 4 years. What then?
That's a good question. I think that there, of course, could be more discussions after 4 years. And I think it also leaves it to people to see what happens within those 4 years, if more things need to be changed or if things are still going smoothly because of these policy changes.
We talked a bit last week when none of you were here about the brouhaha that has developed over light rail, the Silver Line that is scheduled to go from Union County in North Carolina to Gaston County in South Carolina, in also in North Carolina, but goes through Charlotte and past the airport without a stop at the airport. It's going to stop a mile away from the airport, and that's caused some eyebrows to raise, but this week, news of the Charlotte to Atlanta high-speed rail line and the fact that costs are expected to increase in the next planning phase has gotten some folks' attention. By how much will this cost go up, do they think?
I know from all our years of discussing transit, Mike, that those developments shock you. Yeah. So I'm going to give you a moment.
They always go up.
I'm going to give you a moment to collect yourself and just try and ride this one out, pun intended. So they put out this study of the preferred route, and they had the cost estimate of like $6 to $8 billion, which isn't chump change. And then you start digging into this and you realize the numbers are actually from 2012. Mm. So just by inflation, they've already gone up a couple of billion. And then you look over to Texas, where they're proposing a similar length route from Houston to Dallas, and it's about a $20 billion project. So I think you can see where this is headed. The other thing that should be mentioned, Mike, is we're probably 10 years away from construction, and that's optimistic.
And that means the cost will rise even further because of inflation and unknown factors, I suppose. The part of the reason for the increase in price is that the Federal Railroad Administration and the Georgia Department of Transportation is recommending now that they build new tracks in some areas rather than upgrading and sharing existing rail. I can see ears perking up in northern Mecklenburg County with regard to the red line. But let's turn our attention now to the ever elusive streetcar. They've been building the Gold Line for a longer period than Charlotte was the gold capital of the country. Do we have news of its impending start?
They started when Lincoln was inaugurated.
I think so.
It is Katz. The latest I have heard from Katz is that it will be in August. I have not seen a specific date or heard a specific date from them. There's a federal deadline that would lead to financial penalties that usually motivates most of us. So I think that's probably a pretty likely occurrence. And so now they're starting to try and obviously turn the page to what will the service consist of? You know, how much will it help people? How's it going to help build out neighborhoods and those kinds of things? So, Mike, the answer is by Labor Day, you should be riding the streetcar hither and yon.
And this is phase two of this streetcar. There's a third phase. The first phase was a mile and a half, and I think that was the mile and a half that goes down Elizabeth Avenue What does Elizabeth Avenue become? I can't remember.
Yes, it becomes
sudden.
Trade.
Seventh.
Yes.
Eight. What street?
Oh, I'm sorry. I was going the wrong way. Sorry. Yes. I
okay,
live
well,
here.
Never mind. It changes names as all streets in Charlotte do.
Yes.
But that was the old streetcar. The new streetcar is in testing now, and this will go from Johnson C. Smith to where?
So this will pick up. So right now it goes from basically Presbyterian Hospital to the arena.
Okay.
It will extend a little bit, about a half mile from the hospital to the east, and then it'll go a couple of miles from uptown to Johnson C. Smith, and that is phase two. And then there's the third phase that obviously is not under construction. That will be the final 6 miles that will make this a 10-mile streetcar line.
Like light rail, this is being viewed not only as a transportation instrument, but also a development vehicle because it has already caused people to locate businesses and anticipation of the streetcar arriving in certain areas. But transit ridership has been down since the start of the pandemic. It's yet to fully recover. And yet you report, Eric, that Charlotte Transit CEO John Lewis expects this 4-mile gold line will meet or exceed previous projections of 4,100 daily riders. Why the optimism?
That's a good question. I mean, they think for all the usual reasons that additional development, the convenience of people not having to park, all those things that have been rolled out for years during transit discussions, that will come to fruition here. But you're absolutely right, Mike. I was looking this week at transit numbers. Now, this is everything, light rail and buses. They're off 50% this fiscal year from the previous year, which obviously was affected by COVID. So, you know, they've got a long way to go in terms of recovery, but they're confident this is going to work. I will say the one thing that is cause for optimism is you are seeing a lot of investment in land around Johnson C. Smith in terms of, you know, anticipation of the streetcar. And obviously that area is already growing anyway. So that's a good sign.
I was thinking just the other day that something was missing in my life. I felt a certain emptiness, and I discovered what it was, our lack of conversation about the 2040 plan. And now, after that, we thought that was in our rearview mirror, but now Charlotte Center City Partners has its own 2040 vision plan. It's a $600,000 study that began in 2019 that was evidently altered in its perspective by COVID-19 and the social justice movement out of the George Floyd murder in Minneapolis. What does this plan entail, and how was it changed by those events?
You're right, Mike. Everybody has a plan. However, this one with Center City Partners has been done every 10 years since the 60s by the, you know, sort of uptown power brokers. This is the latest iteration. I think the thing that is most interesting about this one is that, as you mentioned, the social justice movement really shifted their focus and their motivation. And the head of Center City Partners was telling me about this idea of an equity fund, racial equity fund, that could possibly be funded through another district tax, that is, you know, on the businesses and property owners in uptown to help with affordable housing, to help minority-owned businesses subsidize their rents because the rents are so expensive uptown. So that's a really interesting and I think somewhat radical idea for this group anyway. So I'm really curious to see how that conversation goes and if they in fact do go forward with that.
And this will tell me we don't need one of those topic music notes before we talk about this 2040 plan
theme song.
Just wait. It's coming. The January 6th Special Congressional Committee held its first hearing this week in D.C., and they'll be talking about this in the next hour during the roundup on 1A. We bring it up because it's news that impacts every caring American. The committee heard harrowing testimony from police officers on the front lines of the insurrection, and they screened more previously unseen footage of that day. All Republicans are poo-pooing this, except for two members of that committee, Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger, who continue, the Republicans to dismiss these hearings. Kinzinger believes his participation poses significant risk to his party's rhetoric about the attack and the investigation. But what effect, Mary, do you think that hearing and future hearings will have on public opinion? I'm curious as to why they weren't in prime time, if they want to really have a big effect.
Well, I think there are some people who are burrowed into their partisan sort of corners. And you saw people dismissing police, their accounts, harrowing, and their injuries. And if you were a human being and an American on this assault on democracy, you couldn't help but be moved. And you heard the frustration from the police that some of the same congresspeople whose lives they protected were poo-pooing what happened to them. And it's interesting because Republicans have always tried to paint themselves as backing the blue, but yet they weren't backing these blue. In fact, there were people there who were rioters holding thin blue line signs and attacking people with them. But you also saw some law enforcement officers who actually were there, who were rioters. So I think it will have an effect, and it's going to be very political. Everything is.
Mm-hmm. And those officers who testified were being vilified, for lack of a better word, on certain right-wing media outlets, which is astounding given their law and order position and their protect the police at all cost thin blue line positions. Before we go today, we have to bid farewell to one of this program's longtime producers. Chris Miller has decided to move on to greener pastures, perhaps in the eternal pursuit of the Komodo dragon or Wally Baloo. We will miss his sense of humor, his innate sense of what makes good radio, his deep appreciation for a really good radio jingle, and of course, his considerable skills. But most of all, we will just miss him. And we wish him well on this new pathway in his life and thank him for his significant contributions to this program. He really made a big difference. Thanks to all of you. Claire Donnelly from WFAE News, Hunter Sines from WCNC TV, Mary Curtis from Roll Call, Eric Spanberg from the Business Journal. And we leave you with the words from the governor.
Get a vaccine today. Don't wait until you or a family member is sick and going on a ventilator. Don't wait until we run out of hospital beds. Don't wait until skyrocketing numbers threaten to shut businesses or cancel sports.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, pledging to help end child hunger in the Carolinas through ongoing support of Second Harvest Food Bank of Metrolina. Details about this initiative at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.